If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 89. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we're back on track with the A to Z project, and we're doing the letter K. And the movies I've chosen for this one, I'll be right up front about it, are The Killers from 1946, directed by Robert Siodmak, with Burt Lancaster and Ava Gardner in it, and the 1964 sort of remake of The Killers, directed by Don Siegel, starring Lee Marvin, Angie Dickinson, and in his last film role, Ronald Reagan. So, how is everybody? I'm looking out the window. We still don't have a garden out there, but it is going in on Wednesday. I'm recording this on Saturday. It's going in on Wednesday. So, next time I do a podcast, I'll be looking upon a garden. So, that'll be quite nice for me. The weather's warming up here as it is getting cold for most of you. And things are heading in towards the holiday season, so that's all chaos. We still don't have the kitchen yet. We have all the cabinets in for the kitchen. We still need to get the slab leveled for the kitchen floor, get the flooring put in, get the bench tops put in, get the appliances plumbed in, and then we'll have a kitchen. But at the moment, we're kind of living on fast food and things we're going to eat cold and all sorts of other unusual things. Tonight, I think we're getting out a gas hot plate, and we're going to cook outside for dinner. So that should be an experience in itself. But things are going great here. You might have noticed if you do try to tune in to the radio gig at ABC local radio in the Northern Territory, that it's not on for 2 weeks. That's because the cricket's on, and cricket is more important than me, apparently. But Ivor and I have still recorded while the cricket's on, so we'll have a couple of extra episodes under our belt. We do them sequentially, so we'll be basically 3 weeks ahead rather than the usual week ahead. But we didn't mind that. The last couple of movies I did were a lot of fun. Yesterday I recorded the talk about The Lady Killers from 1955, the Ealing comedy with Alec Guinness, Peter Sellers, and a few other people in it. And that was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed that movie. It's another one of those feel-good films. It's a very dark comedy, but it's an enjoyable film. And it's we just grooved on it. We really did enjoy it and had a great time doing that one. And the week before that, we did, he said, thinking back and having a totally unreliable memory, how could I forget, we did Hitchcock's Vertigo and had a good chat about that. We talked about Bernard Herrmann's music. We talked about the choice of Kim Novak as an actress and James Stewart as the actor, and Hitchcock's particular kinks as far as that's concerned. So that one's going to be on the radio in a couple of weeks. I'll put things up on Facebook when it's imminent, and also on Google Plus. You can find me on Google Plus if you want to as well, and on Twitter if you want to go old school. Twitter somehow become old school. But we enjoy doing that too. We're kind of trying to balance out kind of movies that are feel good and movies that are a bit more serious. Next time around, I'm talking about Vanishing Point with Barry Newman, so I'm looking forward to that one. And then we're going to find some lighter fare moving into the holiday season. So, yeah, a bit of a groove and really having a lot of fun with it. Let me see what I have been watching apart from that. I saw Dead Again, the movie with Kenneth Branagh, Emma Thompson, and Andy Garcia, and Derry Jacobi in it, which was kind of like a noir thriller with reincarnation in it and things like that, and I quite enjoyed it. I saw it when it first came out in the early 90s, but it was a bit of fun and quite stylish in its own way, and I always like movies with Emma Thompson in it because she's an interesting actress and quite sexy. So there was that one there. Let's see what else we've got. I did see Carnival of Souls. TCM showed it over Halloween here in Australia. So I watched Carnival of Souls, Herc Harvey's movie from 1962, and enjoyed it a lot. It really is a one-off mood piece and in its own way quite terrifying. So that was a bit of a laugh. I did see XXX. I watched the Vin Diesel movie XXX again. I got it incredibly cheaply on Blu-ray for some reason. I think I had to get like two for $20 or something, so I picked that one up when the actual thing I wanted was the other movie, The Lady Killers. But yeah, it's an action film, and Vin Diesel, as an actor, makes a good lump of meat. But having said that, I did see a movie from about 1984 called Runaway. It's a science fiction movie starring Tom Selleck. Kirstie Alley's in it as well. It's about a kind of police squad that looks after runaway robots. And the villain's played by Gene Simmons, the kiss Gene Simmons, not the chick Gene Simmons. And that was okay. The technology doesn't really hold up well compared to contemporary stuff, but you can't really expect it to, given the fact that it's, what, 26, 27 years old. But it was a bit of fun. I hadn't seen it in a long time, so I thought I'd check that out. I did also watch High Anxiety, the Mel Brooks movie, because I was on a Hitchcock run after watching Vertigo, so I thought I'd watch the ultimate Hitchcock film, High Anxiety, which I do enjoy checking out. I watched Chaplin with Robert Downey Jr., which is a recommended film as well, directed by Richard Attenborough. Quite an interesting bit, even though the old age makeup doesn't quite work when Downey Jr. is playing the elderly Chaplin, but the rest of it is holds up pretty well. It's quite a nice little biopic. But the film of the fortnight for me was The Day of the Locust, the movie from the 1970s directed by John Schlesinger, which stars William Atherton, Karen Black's in it, and Donald Sutherland. So here's your trivia question. Which movie has Homer Simpson stomping a kid to death outside a movie premiere? The answer is Day of the Locust, because Donald Sutherland's character in this film is called Homer Simpson. But yeah, it's a kind of 1930s piece set in Hollywood based on, I think, Nathaniel West's book. I could be wrong, but I'll check that out. And yeah, it holds up really well. It's a very dark and apocalyptic view of Hollywood in the 1930s. But the period design is very good. The acting is superb. And it really is something that you do need to see. And it's not the fondest view of Hollywood that you're going to see in a movie if you do, but I hadn't seen it in maybe 20 years, so I thought I'd give it a go, and I did find it very enjoyable in a dark and troubled way. So that's pretty much what I've been watching. I've been watching other things too, but with all the moving around of the furniture and the renovation going on and chasing up contractors and doing all those sorts of other things that Sal and I have both had to do recently, haven't had enough time to do those sort of enjoyable things. And it's also getting into the party season now. Went out to the other side of town, had dinner with some friends. And oh, that's the other thing I saw. I didn't put it on Mizzo. Went over to my friends Jamie and Sarah's place for dinner. They got in a new smoker, so we had smoked meats and salads and things. And we saw Night and Day with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. Fuck, that's a horrible film. That is the antithesis of enjoyable. It really is. Apparently, Tom Cruise had a lot of say in the film, which is never a good thing to let a lot of the decisions about what goes into the film be made by a megalomaniacal Scientologist, but they chose to go that way. And the fascinating things I found about the film were two. One, the tone of the film was totally fucked. There was, tonally, it just didn't work. It was seriously, deeply wrong in that way. You couldn't tell what tone they were going for. The pacing was off. There was no kind of arc to anything. It was just a dog's breakfast. The other thing is that Cameron Diaz and Tom Cruise had negative charisma for each other. They really did not connect. You could see Cameron Diaz was trying. She was giving it her best there, but ick is all I can say to that film. And that was the consensus of opinion by all four people and two cats who were in attendance at the time. So I'm going to take a break now and play something for you, and then we're going to get back and talk about the 1946 killer, the killers, sorry, Burt Lancaster's first film. So I'm going to take a break now, and I'm going to play for you, he said, looking up what I have to play for people, a track from the movie version of the stage musical Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, which he's not anymore. It is Mort Schumann singing the Funeral Tango.
I can see them now, clutching a handkerchief and blowing me a kiss, discreetly asking how. How come he died so young, or was he very old? Is the body still warm? Is it already cold? All doors are opened wide, they poke around inside. My desk, my drawers, my trunk, there's nothing left to hide. Some love letters are there, and an old photograph. They've laid my poor soul bare, and all they do is laugh. Ha 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 ha. I can see them all, so formal and so stiff, like a sergeant at arms at the policeman's ball. And everybody's pushing to be the first in line, their hearts upon their sleeves like a 10-cent valentine. The old women are there, too old to give a damn. They even brought the kids who don't know who I am. They're thinking about the price of my funeral bouquet. What they're thinking isn't nice, 'cause now they'll have to pay. Ha 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 ha. I see all of you, all of my phony friends, who can't wait till it ends, who can't wait till it's through. Oh, I see all of you, you've been laughing all these years, and now all that you have left are a few crocodile tears. You don't even know that you're entering your hell as you leave my cemetery, and you think you're doing well with that one who's at your side. You're as proud as you can be. Ah, she's going to make you cry, but not the way you cried for me. Ha 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 ha.
Oh, I can see me now, so cold and so alone, as the flowers slowly die in my field of little bones. Oh, I can see me now, I can see me at the end of this voyage that I'm on, without a love, without a friend.
Now all this that I see is not what I deserve. They really have a nerve to say these things to me. No, girls, just bread and water, all your money you must save, for there'll be nothing left for us when you're dead and in your grave. Ha, 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 ha.
That's one of the songs I want people to play when I take my dirt nap eventually, and hopefully not for at least another half a century or more. Yep, so let's get on to The Killers, 1946. It's a Universal film, and as I said, it is the first film starring Burt Lancaster, who had previously been a stage actor. He had been a circus acrobat with his mate Nick Cravatte, and in general, on the fringes of show business, but not really the center of it. And at the age of 30, he got this chance to be in the film, this film, The Killers. And he does a pretty good job of it. You can see the start of him as quite a striking film actor in this movie. I'll play the bit. Well, there's no real spoiler to the fact that his character dies, because it happens right at the start of the film. Two hitmen played by William Conrad, who people might remember from the Canon TV series, and Charles McGraw, go into the town of Brentwood, New Jersey. They go to a diner where they know that the Swede, as he's called, usually goes to dinner every night at 6 p.m. They bail up the people working in there and then find out where the Swede lives. He hasn't turned up for some reason, and go to kill him, basically. His friend Nick Adams, who's the kind of viewpoint character of the original Ernest Hemingway story this is built on, goes and tries to warn the Swede. And that's the scene I'm going to play for you right now.
Swede, I was over at Henry's. A couple of guys came in and tied up me and the cook. They shoved us in the kitchen. They said they were going to shoot you when you came in to supper. Well, George thought I ought to come over and tell you.
There's nothing I can do about it.
I can tell you what they look like.
I don't want to know what they're like. Thanks for coming.
Don't you want me to go and see the police?
No. That wouldn't do any good.
Isn't there something I could do?
There ain't anything to do.
Couldn't you get out of town?
No. I'm through with all that running around.
Why do they want to kill you?
I did something wrong once. Thanks for coming.
And with that, Nick goes away, and Swede is killed by the two button men. An insurance investigator comes along, played by Edmund O'Brien, and wants to find out why Swede didn't resist the hitmen, why he didn't run away, why he didn't try to fight them. He was an ex-boxer. He's a big guy, as indeed Burt Lancaster was. And they're trying to find this insurance investigator called Reardon, tries to find out why Swede gave up so easily. So you've got two stories running in parallel. You've got Reardon's investigation in the latest part, and then in flashback you've got the story about how the Swede met a woman called Kitty Collins, got involved with some crimes, and eventually ended up sitting in a cheap room waiting for people to kill him. So there's two stories in parallel. There's the investigation part, and then there's the flashback story. And it works really, really well. It's a beautifully filmed film noir. Now, Robert Siodmak, the director, was the brother of Kurt Siodmak, who wrote any number of Universal horror films at the time. And Siodmak himself, Robert Siodmak, did a number of good films as well. He did Crisscross again with Burt Lancaster, and he also directed my favourite pirate movie of all time, The Crimson Pirate, with Burt Lancaster. So he was one of those German emigres who, with his brother Kurt, fled Germany and Goebbels and Hitler's influence. They were both Jews, and ended up with a gig in Hollywood. Now, there are a couple of interesting things that Siodmak did with this film that really do take it out of the ordinary. The first thing is he insisted that the lighting be as naturalistic as possible. What lights would they have in a place? Make them more intense so you can film it, but only have lights positioned as they need to be. In the diner scene, where they'd usually have 20 lights lighting up the set, Siodmak had only 5 arc lights, because he worked out where the lights should be in a diner, and he put them in there. And when the button men are standing outside the diner, you can see the light coming through the windows very naturally. And you can see the street lights in the street set looking very natural, with deep shadows where the street lights don't fall. And it does bring an intensity and that kind of film noir deep shadow to all of the scenes. So that's one thing Siodmak did. There's a scene where the guys are playing poker, and normally you'd have a whole bunch of different lights around for the, when the crims are playing poker. But Siodmak insisted on there being one downlight. So even when the eyes and part of the faces of the actors are in shadow, Siodmak doesn't put any more lighting into it. So it gives this beautiful, deep black and white darkness to the filming, which really does enhance it. Now, the other thing he did, which works very well as well, Ava Gardner, this was her first big starring role, and it's the one that really kind of made her as a star. She came on set the first day and had the full makeup that she'd been taught to wear from MGM. She was on loan to Universal at the time. And Siodmak took her aside and said, "Come back with all the makeup off. I just want to see your face." And she's the first big Hollywood actress to go without makeup in a movie. They put a little bit of Vaseline on her face to give her that kind of glow. And once Siodmak saw it in the dailies, he kind of built the lighting, that naturalistic lighting, around that kind of rapturous glow and the stunning face of Ava Gardner. She really was an incredibly, an intensely beautiful woman. People talk about Angelina Jolie now being sexy and attractive and all that sort of thing before she got really skinny. But Ava Gardner has a sensuality and a sexuality that comes across really, really well on the screen. In fact, during their first scene together, Burt Lancaster got a hard on while they were doing it, while they're in the clinches. It doesn't usually happen. You do things to kind of avoid it. But he was fairly new to the acting game on screen, and he cracked a fat. And it amused everybody, including himself. And Ava Gardner just took it as a compliment and laughed it off the way that the earthy kind of woman she was would do. But it just goes to show that she had an immediate and priapic effect on the men around her at the time. She was incredibly sexy and not too adverse to following through. At the time, she was married to the band leader, Artie Shaw, who helped negotiate her fee for the movie and got it upped significantly by going in and negotiating for her. But she's fantastic in this film, and there's a scene with her sitting on a bed wearing a skirt and a sweater, and I can tell she's not wearing a bra in that scene, and it does have an impact. And she's very, very good in the role too. She was very, again, it was early in her career as well, and she had some problems with some of the more emotional scenes, particularly during the climax, but Siodmak basically yelled at her to get her into the emotional state he wanted. He'd been very nice to her right up until then, but he started yelling and ranting a bit. Not because he was genuinely pissed off with her. He knew that she needed something to get her over the hump of that emotional intensity. And so he did that in order to get the best bit out of her during the crucial scenes at the climax. So, and the ensemble in this film is pretty spectacular as well. They've got some very fine actors in the background. Well, not in the background, but as the secondary characters. You've got Emmett O'Brien, of course, playing Reardon the Investigator. O'Brien, people know from things like DOA and The Barefoot Contessa, which he did again with Ava Gardner as well, and won an Academy Award for. Sam Levine's in this as well, playing a police lieutenant, Sam Lubinsky, who's a friend of the Swedes. And Sam Levine, he was one of the original stars of Guys and Dolls on the stage in Broadway. And he also was the cop that Nick and Nora Charles always liaised with in the Thin Man movie. So he does a good piece and a very naturalistic piece as the cop friend of the Swedes, and really an interesting actor and an interesting character in this film as well. So who else have we got? We've got William Conrad, of course, as I said, and Charles McGraw. One of the other people I should mention who's in this film that I always find interesting is Jeff Corey. Jeff Corey was blacklisted as an actor. He's a very fine character actor. He plays a character in this film called, I'm just trying to think of the name, Blinky Franklin. And he does some really nice bits in there as well, and has a scene. Now, the producer of the movie, I should say, was a guy called Mark Hellinger, who'd been a reporter in New York for a long time before he came over to Hollywood and decided to write movies. And this is his first production as a producer for a film. Now, there's a bit where Blinky is dying in a hospital as a part of the plot, and he's delirious and ranting. And the interesting thing is that Hellman was at the death of the gangster Dutch Schultz, reporting on it for his newspaper at the time, and he based Blinky's rantings on the kind of fever dream rantings that Dutch Schultz had just before he died in hospital himself. So he's trying to base as much as he could the things that the characters in the film do on reality, which is kind of an interesting approach to doing it. The other interesting thing is that only the first 15 minutes or so of the movie are the Hemingway short story, and it's quite a true adaptation within certain limitations of Hemingway's short story, The Killers. But after that, Hellinger went up to Hemingway, because they knew each other, you know, from New York, and said, "What's the rest of the story?" And Hemingway said, "How the hell should I know? Make it up." So Hellinger got, amongst other people, John Huston to help him figure out what the backstory to the Swede is and what should happen in it. And in doing so, they created one of the great femme fatales of film noir in Kitty Collins. She's devastatingly attractive. She's duplicitous. She does triple crosses on people. She's a nasty piece of work, wrapped up in an incredibly attractive package. And the other thing that Siobhan did, and I don't want to underestimate how good this guy was at what he did as a director, is he didn't get Ava Gardner to overplay it. He didn't want her to play large. He'd say, bring it back to 50% and things like that. So her acting is very understated. It's very kind of withdrawn a little bit, which is a contrast to the kind of dazzling physical impact she has. The character is kind of very low key, and the men come to her, she doesn't go to them, she presents herself to them. And that makes for a nice reverse on what people expect. People expect film noir femme fatales to be right out there and slob it all over people and everything but a billboard. But that's not what we get in this one. We get somebody who knows that she can manipulate men and lets the men be manipulated by their own desires. And that's really, really interesting. The other person in this film is the gangster that Kitty Collins is married to, played by Albert Dekker. Albert Dekker, people might remember from Dr. Cyclops. He was Dr. Cyclops in that. And I did see him very recently in another film. There's a 1950s filmed in Puerto Rico about cane plantations and lust and desire and all sorts of shit like that, called Machete. And Albert Dekker's in that one too. Albert Dekker had an interesting life. He was one of the things he did as well was he was an assemblyman in the California legislature for a few years representing Hollywood, and was actually running for mayor of Los Angeles around the time this film was made. The other thing about Albert Dekker is he died in 1962. Might have been 68, I'm not sure, 62 or 68, but he died of autoerotic strangulation. He was found after a couple of days of nobody seeing him, tied up and strung up in his shower in an incredibly unfortunate and compromising position. 1968 it was, in a very compromising position, which is an unfortunate way for an actor to be remembered. And he was a good, sturdy actor. He was very smart, too, because what he did was, he was a Democrat, and he was very, you know, left of centre. And just as the House Un-American Activities mob was starting to really do what they did to kind of help destroy people's careers, he went to Broadway and became a stage actor. He moved to the stage and did a lot of things. He actually replaced the original guy in Death of a Salesman, for instance, in the first run of that, and he took his career onto the stage so he wouldn't have to worry about being blacklisted in Hollywood, which is quite a smart move. But he's very malevolent in this film as well, and even though his hairpiece is a bit obvious, But the Killers is great. I haven't seen it for a couple of years, and I watched it again this morning. And the cinematography is really great. There's a scene where Swede bails up the other gangsters, climbs through a window and bails them up. And there's a fantastic camera angle looking down over his shoulder while he's at the top of a flight of stairs and the guys are below. Beautifully filmed, beautiful depth of focus on the camera work. As there are in a number of the scenes in this film. And it's some of the best black and white photography I've seen in a long time. It really doesn't draw attention to itself, but it does, that depth of field and that realistic lighting give you a real kind of gritty sense of reality about a film, which, you know, is an entertainment and isn't realistic in other ways, but it really does have a lot of punch. And there's a scene where Swede's having his last fight as well. He breaks his hand and can't fight anymore, and the way they film that and the way that the, you know, the dressing rooms and things at the boxing ring are done show that Hellinger and other people really knew their stuff when it came to realistic sets. There's a shower off to one side of the dressing room. There's a doctor's in a little alcove in near the dressing rooms and all sorts of things like that. There's an interesting sense of realism about it, which really does work to carry the slightly more fantastic and unlikely parts of the story through. So I don't want to say anything more than that about the Killers. It really is a classic film noir. It's got a beautiful story structure with two parallel storylines, one in flashback, one set in the present, in quotation marks. Terrific acting. You can see the start of Burt Lancaster as a fine actor. And as somebody else has mentioned, I think it was Jonathan Lethem in the Criterion essay about it, you can see that at the very start of his career, Burt Lancaster was playing weak and troubled characters in parallel to later things he did, like The Swimmer. You can see that kind of thread through Burt Lancaster's career. He did The Swashbuckling and The Adventure roles, like His Majesty O'Keefe and The Crimson Pirate and Elmer Gantry and all those kind of flashy roles. But there's also been that thread of weak characters, which is an interesting place for such a dynamic and physical actor to be in. And in this film, he does show that too, when he's boxing and when Swede's moving around in the flashback scenes. You can really see that intense and kind of controlled physicality that Burt Lancaster had, which makes this even more interesting. And there is very much a chemistry between himself and Ava Gardner's character. There was never anything off-screen. She was involved with Artie Shore, and Burt Lancaster was involved elsewhere. But the rapport is very much there and really does help to carry the story.
Jake tells me you're a fighter.
Do you like the fights?
I'm afraid I've never seen one.
No kidding.
I hate brutality, Mr. Anderson. The idea of two men beating each other to a pulp makes me ill.
I saw all Swede's fights.
How wonderful of you. I could never bear to see a man I really care for being hurt.
Kitty?
Oh, excuse me.
So I'm going to take another break now, and when I come back, we're going to talk about the second version of The Killers, the Don Siegel 1964 one.
Give me some men who are stout-hearted men who will fight for the right they adore. Start me with 10 who are stout-hearted men, and I'll soon give you 10,000 more. Shoulder to shoulder and bolder and bolder, they grow as they go to the fore. Then there's nothing in the world can hold or mar a plan. When stout-hearted men can stick together, man to man. You who have dreams, if you ask, they will be yours to turn your dream to a fact. It's up to you. If you have a soul and a spirit, never fear it, you'll see it through.
Hearts can inspire other hearts with their fire.
For the strong obey when a strong man shows them the way.
Some men who are stout-hearted men who will fight for the right they adore. Start me with 10 who are stout-hearted men, and I'll soon give you 10,000 more. Oh.
Shoulder to shoulder and bolder, they grow as they go to the fore.
And there's nothing in the world can halt or mar.
And bolder,
they grow as they go to the fore.
Okay, let's get on to The Killers from 1964. This one was a bit of an odd thing. It was made as a TV movie, but turned out to be too violent for television, so it was released theatrically. But the cast on this is something rather incredible. For a start, you've got Lee Marvin in there just before Cap Ballou, just before he really hit the big time. He'd done movies before this, of course, as far back as the early 50s. But this one is really kind of, in a weird way, the role he plays presages his character in Point Blank. It's very much a similar kind of thing, though. Of course, John Borman did a lot better with it than Don Siegel did. Don Siegel had to work within the constraints of what they thought was going to be a television movie. So you've got Lee Marvin playing Charlie. Angie Dickinson doing the kind of Ava Gardner-ish role. You've got John Cassavetes, very cool actor and a fine director as well, as Johnny North, who is the equivalent of the Swede in this one. You've got Gulliger. I knew I'd get that wrong. Clue Gulliger as Lee, the other assassin. You've got Claude Akins in there. And, of course, you have Ronald Reagan playing the role played by Albert Dekker in the original movie. Now, Ronald Reagan did not like this role because he was a soft cock and did not want to play a bad guy. I don't think he did a particularly good bad guy. I think he played more like the president, you know, fuck with, because he looked not too dissimilar than he did when he was playing the US president, I was going to say, but maybe that's accurate. He was never a very nuanced actor, let's be honest with it. No one believed him even when he was a president. But in this one, he's playing the tough guy who is guy who keeps the Angie Dickinson character in the manner that, to which she should become accustomed. And it's quite fun to watch this for that reason. Not often you see an American president dissing a woman and having a shootout with Lee Marvin. So, very cool. Again, it's got the same structure as the original Killers. Two assassins go into, in this case, a school for the blind where Johnny is a teacher, and assassinate him amidst his blind school students, mature age students they are. And of course they can't identify the killers because of that. So, but the character played by Lee Marvin, whose name is, he said, looking this up because it's been a long day, Charlie, can't understand why Johnny just let him get plugged. He'd done a lot of the hits in his time. He'd never seen anybody who just gave up like that. And so he hears that Johnny was involved with the Ronald Reagan character, a guy called Jack Browning, and they'd done a big heist, and Charlie and Lee decide there's money somewhere and they're going to go and get it. And they set out to track down what happened to the money and why Johnny North just gave in when they came to kill him. Now, this, of course, takes the place of the insurance investigator played by Edmund O'Brien in the original film. And it's not too bad a choice. The problem with this film is, of course, the constraints of doing what they thought was going to be a television movie. And that kind of limits things a little bit for them. Though Marvin and Gulliga and Cassavetes and Angie Dickens and Claude Akins is in it as well, really kind of bring a bit of style to the movie. And particularly Cassavetes brings more to it than you'd expect an actor to bring to a television movie, and does quite a good job. I don't think he's quite right for the role. He doesn't play weakness very well, Cassavetes. He plays intensity incredibly well as an actor, but he never played weakness quite as well as someone like Burt Lancaster. But of course, this is initially a television movie, so you're not going to get your A-team on there. And that's the other problem with this too, is Angie Dickinson. Of course, her and Lee Marvin appeared against each other again in Point Blank, which I talked about in a previous podcast. But Angie Dickinson doesn't have quite what Ava Gardner has. You can't really understand why Johnny totally loses his head over this woman the way that you can definitely understand the way that the Swede loses his head over Kitty Collins. But having said that, the direction's very good. I mean, Don Siegel, fantastic action director. He's got his two killers in their really suave, madman-era suits with the sunglasses on, and they've got some racing car sequences in, because Johnny raced sports cars, he was a racing car driver. You've got that kind of 1960s era hip happening there. The other thing I noticed when I was watching these two films back to back is, in the 1946 version, you've got that beautiful film noir lighting, and in the version that came out in 1964, you've got television lighting. So you've got basically no shadows anywhere, very bright lighting, no light and dark in there, and that kind of does make a difference. Now, one of the things that Don Siegel said about this film is that they filmed the last scene, the big shootout scene at the end, first. One of the problems they had, well, it wasn't necessarily a problem. One of the things they had to deal with was the fact that both Lee Marvin and Clue Gulliger had gone out and got drunk the night before, as you do. And fortunately, there was no dialogue in that last bit, so they managed to get through it and filmed it, in spite of the fact that they were pissed and they would have slowed their words had there been any dialogue. But, it's interesting to do these back-to-back. In fact, Umbrella Entertainment in Australia has released the two films in a double pack a couple of years ago, which is where I picked them up. Now, I'm just looking through the IMDb trivia on this, because it's a bit hard to get trivia in reference books from this sort of a movie. Let's see, who was the other actors considered for John Cassavetes' role were Steve McQueen, Rod Taylor, Cliff Robertson, George Peppard, Robert Wagner, Bobby Darin, George Maharis, Tom Tryon, and Lee Marvin. I can't see any of them really doing that. Among the other actors considered for Ronald Reagan's role were Barry Nelson, Gig Young, John Forsythe, Leslie Nielsen, Van Johnson, Richard Conte, Steve Cochran, Richard Basehart, and Walter Matthau. That would have been interesting. Let's see what else we've got here. Apparently, it's the only movie in which Ronald Reagan played a bad guy, and he hated doing it, but, you know, what a soft cock. Okay, here we go. Other actors considered for Lee Marvin's role were Stephen Hill. You might remember him from the first two seasons of Mission Impossible. Neville Brand, Carol O'Connor, Charles Bronson, James Coburn, Ralph Meeker, and Barry Sullivan. So they were looking to get some interesting people for this one. The other thing that's interesting is the movie's got a score by John Williams, but The opening and end title music were lifted from Touch of Evil score by Henry Mancini for some reason. So studios did that. When they were doing TV things, they weren't adverse to nicking bits of music from their previous films and stock footage and whatever else they could get away with in order to fill out what they had and the budgetary constraints that they had there. But I kind of like this one. I think it plays better as if you kind of realize it's a TV movie. You're a bit more forgiving of it and a bit more accepting of it. But the acting is quite fine. Lee Marvin does a superb job. Clu Gulager is good in it. Reagan's Reagan. And Cassavetes in there. So just in any movie that you've got Lee Marvin, you've got John Cassavetes. It's pretty fucking cool in my book. Now, I'm just going to play a bit where Clu Gulager and Lee Marvin are bailing up Angie Dickinson to try to find out where the missing money is.
Who is it? Just a minute. What do you want?
Hey, Charlie, I'm Lee.
You weren't supposed to come until 9 o'clock.
That's right, we're early.
Now, see here.
Oh, shut up, Charlie, and sit down.
Charlie, don't bruise us, Charlie. She got a lot of class.
All right. You've proved you can be rude. Now, what do you want?
The money.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Nobody ever knows what we're talking about, Charlie.
A man stood still while we burned him. And I'd like to know why. Now, I figure that if you phoned us after talking to Browning, then maybe you had some answers.
And also, you might know where the money is since nobody else seems to.
Jack must have told you what happened to the money.
Yeah, Browning says that you have it. I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. You throw the bundle to us. We'll make sure that Mr. Browning never disturbs you again. Fair enough?
I tell you, I don't have the money.
What did you say? Where is it?
Can't you get it through your heads? Johnny North took it. He slugged Jack and got away clean.
You mean he struck him?
He certainly told you about it.
Well, struck him, huh?
I wonder... I kinda.
Don't like your story, lady. Oh. Would you tell me another one, please?
As you can hear from that, there's some bad overdubbing on Clu Gulager's voice in this film, but it doesn't really detract from it at all. So what have we got? So we've got the 1946 movie, we've got the 1964 movie, remade basically for content for television, but released theatrically. And one of the things that I did find out about the 46, so I'll go back to the 46 for a moment, is that one of the things Siodmak, the director, wanted was to get actors who had been in the war. This was 46, of course, just after the war, so actors who had basically lived a little bit and had that experience and that toughness and that knowledge of their innate toughness, and that worked really well. William Conrad and all the people who were supposed to be tough in that film had been in the war in various ways. And what I thought when I was watching the 1964 one was Lee Marvin, of course, was a Marine at Saipan and was wounded on the island of Saipan, and he brings that lovely toughness to it, which outacts the soft cock Ronald Reagan, who dodged the draft in that sense. He never went overseas during the war. So I think that Siodmak was in the right frame of mind there when he was looking for tough actors to really kind of go with it and to get somebody who could bring that experiential gravitas to what he was doing. And Lee Marvin always had that too. I mean, somebody should do a podcast where they just do Lee Marvin films. It's not going to be me because I get bored with it. But really, you could go through the whole career of Lee Marvin one movie at a time and have interesting things to say about him and in that movie. Even in his later career when he was as pissed as a newt and really didn't bring his A game to the films, they're always interesting and they're always Yeah, there's something missing in a lot of modern cinema and a lot of modern acting. I read something that said that it was basically because kids weren't allowed to play outside and they couldn't go and have adventures and explore the way earlier generations, including my own, were able to. But I really don't know. I think that tough people are a rarity in cinema these days, or at least in Hollywood and mainstream cinema. Independent cinema has some wonderful tough guys, including people like Ben Kingsley and Sexy Beast and all that sort of stuff. But what do people think is the reason why actors aren't as tough as they used to be? That's my question for this one. So if you want to leave feedback on that, please do. Or if you disagree with me, if you think that actors are as tough as they used to be, tell me why. But The Killers has really brought this out. Even somebody like Burt Lancaster playing a character who is essentially a weak character in The Killers really does have something that you can't really fake it. You've got to have the genuine article. You can't emulate it. You can't fake it. You can't learn it in an actor's studio. I mean, even Sinatra had it. Sinatra wasn't in the war, of course, but Sinatra grew up on some pretty fucking rough streets in Hoboken and kind of brought that to it as well. So maybe the modern middle-class guy taken out of a comfortable home with loving parents and all that sort of thing, can they play a tough guy in a movie? Or does it take somebody who maybe grew up with the realization that the world isn't a fair place and that things can come at you from unusual angles and knock you on your ass? So that's what I'm taking from this one and from this podcast is tough guys have to be developed, not you can't learn it. So as I said, there's more to say about the first movie than the second one in this case. So I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to take another break and play some more music. And when I get back, we've got a little bit of feedback and then we'll wrap it up and let you get on with your day.
Can't tell a waltz from a tango. I never know what my feet are gonna do. Oh, I can't tell a waltz from a tango. Darling, when I dance with you, the music sounds inviting, dear, and you are so exciting, dear. But every time you hold me near, I seem to lose my sense of rhythm when your cheek is next to mine. I can't tell a waltz from a tango. I never know what my feet are gonna do. Oh, I can't tell a waltz from a tango. Darling, when I dance with you, if this is love, it's new to me. Oh, won't you give some clue to me? I don't know what you do to me. I seem to lose my sense of rhythm when your cheek is next to mine. I can't tell a waltz from a tango. I never know what my feet are gonna do. No, I can't tell a waltz from a tango. Darling, when I dance with you. The dance steps old and new. I've even won a prize or two. But when I steal a kiss from you, I seem to lose my sense of rhythm when your cheek is next to mine. I can't tell a waltz from a tango. I never know what my feet are gonna do. Oh, I can't tell a waltz from a tango. Darling, when I dance with you. Darling, when I dance with you. Darling, when I dance with you.
That was Elmer Cogan with I Can't Tell a Waltz from a Tango. You're not going to hear that on other podcasts, believe me. So feedback, we've got two pieces, actually, we've only got two pieces of feedback, so I'm going to leave it till next time around. I want to make this a short podcast. Things are, as I said, up in the air, and I really haven't been able to get everything together the way I'd like to for it. I just want to do a name check on all of the the groovy other podcasts are out there and then fold this up. So I apologize to those who have left wonderful feedback for me. I will get back to it next time around. But time's getting away from me and I've really got to kind of wind this little puppy up. So next time around, who knows what will happen. I'm not sure what I'm doing next time. I want to get some more people on, as I've said. But it does depend on how much of the house is assembled. At the moment, things are kind of everywhere. So first off, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema and the B-Movie Cast. Vince, Nick and Mary over there have been doing some wonderful stuff. As are the GGTMC people. Hammockers Podcast with our old mate Brian. Also, Silver and Gold with Alex and Dr. Zom. Fantastic podcast in its own right as well. And Brother D's now doing a new one too, a Hammer movie podcast too. So if you go to the Mail Order Zombie website, you'll find the link to that. I can't find it at the moment. Go to Rupert Pupkin Speaks and Rupert's blog there. He's doing a lot of stuff. Let's see what we've got there. Cool Shite on the Tube. I've got to mention the Cool Shiters. Writer and the Critic, Kirsty and Mondy Talking Books. And also the wonderful Shooting the Poo podcast as well. If I've left anybody out, please tell me. And by the way, people, I am able to put promos for other podcasts in here. So please email them to me, cultguru@gmail.com, and I'll do a little bit of a contra deal with you. I probably want to get out a new promo for Paleo Cinema as well. Oh, by the way, Girls on Film podcast as well. Can't forget them. And I'm going to have to make myself a list for next time. You guys know how disorganized I am. Also, Thursday night's Australian time, I'll be doing the gig on the radio, which is endless grooviness for me. I really do get a buzz out of it. I record them on Fridays, and it's just the best way I know. Well, it's not the best way I know, but one of the best ways I know of ending a work week is to go down to South Bank Studios, spend 45 minutes or so shooting the shit about movies with Ivor up in Darwin. And also, we spend about 30 minutes recording. We do it end-to-end, 30 minutes non-stop. And then spend 15 minutes just shooting the shit and catching up with each other at the ABC's expense, in fact. So that's quite lovely. He's actually done a bit of promo for me for the podcast on the radio as well, because I'm a non-profit organisation. The Australian Broadcasting Commission can do that. And Ivor's been kind enough to do a little bit of a promotion. So if you're listening to the podcast from the Northern Territory, thank you. I'm going to be back up there in May with Sal. We're going to go first couple of weeks of May, which is the loveliest time of the year to go up to Darwin. And we may try to do a meetup if people are interested. So that's about it this time around. I'm going to play us out with some music and take care. Please do keep the feedback in. I will be getting to it next time around. In fact, I may do the feedback at the start of the podcast, so you've got to wade your way through it to hear about the movies. Anyway, take care of yourselves. Sal's doing fine. The cats are doing fine. Look after yourselves. If you're in a cold place, look after yourself particularly. And if you're in the heat like I am, enjoy the fuck out of it. Take care, people.
You smiled at me so sweetly. Since then one thought occurs.
And there was blue in the winter sky. You pinned my violets to your furs and gave a lift to the crowd passing by.
You smiled at me so sweetly.